Hi, hello, welcome. Look, before we get to the podcast with Celtics blogs, Adam Taylor, there's been a trade. Chris Dunn and the Celtics legend, Carson Edwards, are on their way to Memphis in exchange for Juancho Hernangómez and a second round pick swap. Joe is on the call to break it all down. Joe, how you doing, sir?
Good. I'm back out of semi-retirement.
We love it. Love
probably
to see
teetering
it.
Probably teetering on returning back to semi-retirement, but it's a Saturday morning and we're locked down. I've got nothing else to do. So
fair
here
enough.
We are.
Oh, very, very glad to have you. As far as Hernangómez go, which I'm declaring the plural for Hernangómez's, did we get the best one? What are your thoughts on the trade overall, Joe?
Mate, there's one show in the Hernangómez town.
There we go. Pun number one.
Ding!
In your pun counter.
Put a sound in effect. Yeah, no, I know nothing about him. All I know is that he was good enough at one point to get a $7 million a year multi-year contract. Mm-hmm. So all it means is it's just a better – like maybe he works out. It costs us nothing. Although I was kind of hoping, like before we signed Schroeder, I was kind of like a little bit like, oh, I wonder how Chris Dunn will go. But realistically, Carson, he's done. And, I mean, he'll get one more shot. And then that'll be it for him in the NBA. And then, so we gave up a second-round pick swap, really, for it. And I think it gives us better change. It just frees up a roster spot. And there's a like he's a proper NBA player, right? So there's a reasonable chance the guy's going to contribute.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm pretty happy about it, man. Like, it just, I'm sort of having trade machine thoughts in my head, and I think it's better to have one piece that earns $7 million than say three pieces that combine earn $7 million, because roster spots are still at a premium. It's, you can't make mid season trades, right? With like 3-for-1 mid season trades are so hard to do, It just makes having exact change way more likely. I think having a piece like this, and he's probably going to get minutes and contribute positively.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned the exact change concept there, Joe. It's something that you bring up pretty regularly on the podcast, and to have that kind of exact change in the form of a $7-ish million expiring contract. Of course, he's not guaranteed next year, and the fact that it fills a hole kind of for the Celtics. Like, we needed some shooting at the four spot. It's not the same level as Kyle Anderson or Larry Nance Jr., but it is that archetype, and it's something that we need, I guess, in the sort of the Semi Ojeleye slot, who can receive those kick-out passes and hopefully knock down a couple of threes while grabbing a few boards and playing a look at defense as well.
Hopefully. Yeah.
We'll see. There's a comment in the thread from a Wolves fan, the notorious JN, who said, don't have any expectations for him, just to set that bar low right off the bat. He's streaky from three, but if he has a healthy offseason, he might be decent as a spot up four. At a worst, you've cleared a roster spot and you get $7 million off the salary next season. So, not bad. Yeah. I don't know what else really there is to say on the matter. It's kind of all the details are still emerging. Do you think you'll get much of a spot on the roster or part of the rotation this coming season?
Yeah, heck yeah. I think most of the amateur analysts that I respect the most seem to want, hey, we need a bigger wing who can shoot and defend upper position. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of guys that can defend down. So there's definitely an opportunity. Of course, if he doesn't make shots, he won't play. That's just how it goes, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, he'll get a shot.
Well, he's a career 35. Yeah, he's a career 35% three-point shooter. So, what is about league average, maybe slightly above. Like I said, he will hopefully slot into that Semi Ojeleye slot, although significantly less buff. He did have a great 14-game stint 2 seasons ago for the T-Wolves at the power forward spot. Played 29 minutes per game, averaged 13.7 boards on 56% effective field goal percentage and 42% from three. So, very small sample size, sort of like your Neesmith college level sample size there, but something to be hopeful for. He's also a career wearer of the number 41, which is not a retired number for the Celtics, one of very few. Joe, can you name 3 Celtics who have worn number 41 in history?
I don't think I can name one.
Is a Canadian 44. Long-haired
Kelly,
gentleman.
Kelly Olynyk did. Okay. Far out. I know 44 gets a few that come through. Man, you're going to have to tell me.
Well,
take me down memory lane, bro.
So I'll go in order of, I guess, name recognition. So Kelly Olynyk was one. We had James Posey in 2008, of course, wearing number 41 and then the long pull-up socks there. Jarvis Venado, who played in 2013 and I've never heard of.
Never heard of the man, yeah. Sorry, Jarvis. Stacey King played for us?
Yeah, in 1997.
How about that?
Yeah.
Stacey King from the Bulls, Stacey King.
I guess so. I don't know if the time lines up there. I guess it does, 1997. Yeah, we've got Bruno Sunday in 2003.
Like his last stop, I guess, you know?
I guess so, Bruno Sunday, okay. Michael Olowokandi, said James Posey.
I remember him.
Curtis Rowe, Tony Massenberg, Marcus Webb. That's the list.
Tony Massenberg. Okay, yeah, I sort of remember that name from, remember that name from like the late 90s, right?
Didn't have a Massenberg poster up on your wall growing up?
Nah, it didn't. Few luminaries there, mate. Few luminaries.
Not bad. Hopefully you can add a little bit more pride to the number 41 there in a Celtics jersey.
hopefully. Yeah. I'm just going to do some quick maths because it's sort of been brought up that he's a 35% shooter. But I thought if we throw out last season, mm-hmm. I wonder what he gets. And I'm just going to do some quick excelling here, if you don't mind. Do you want to fill the air for a second, Ben?
I will. So there are a
I just
got to
go
other...
text to columns.
No worries. Well, while you're cooking up some magic in the Excel kitchen there, Joe, per ESPN's Bobby Marks, Chris Dunn is on an expiring $5 million contract, and Carson Edwards has a $1.9 million team option for next season. The $7.4 million contract for Hernan Gomez next season is non-guaranteed. The two-for-one trade will require Memphis to waive or trade a player before the 15th of September. And then again, per Woj, following up from his initial reporting of the trade, the deal can't be formally completed until September 15, when Chris Dunn and Carson Edwards' contracts are allowed to be aggregated in the trade. But, you know, it's basically done and dusted. Did I fill enough bedtime for you there, Joe?
No, I'm just wondering why that is. Why do they have to wait? Why, especially Carson Edwards, what's the issue there?
Just some sort of CBA rules-based trickery, which we will be covering next week in the CBA for Idiots podcast that we're doing with good old Wade Spoonie there. So I guess stay tuned for
Spoons.
That.
He'll see us, right? Now, I've just crunched the numbers over here. And that guy's a 35% three-point shooter. No doubt about it.
No matter how
he is, man. No matter how you spin it, eh? Yeah. No, he really is.
We tried one, Joe. Look. We tried to make you look good.
We tried. Yeah. He's... Oh, that's all right, though. You know, you'll... end of the day, 35% is enough, you know? It's enough that you have to get guarded, so...
Yep.
That'll do. Yeah.
So, just, I guess, a salute or a tip of the hat to the outgoing personnel there. So, a Reddit comment from Nibanu8 said, Brad Stevens first offseason as Pobo, president of basketball operations. Carson and Tremont both gone. Love this move. Juancho isn't great by any means, but he's better than Edwards for sure. Joe, as we say a heartfelt goodbye to Carson Edwards and Chris Dunn, do you want to give us your thoughts on the Carson Edwards experience now that it's concluded?
I'm sorry it didn't work out. It was one of my favorite summer league teams of all time, that 2019 draft. It was a hell of a lot of fun, and it was, you know, it was a soothing balm for us after the disaster that had proceeded for it. But, yeah, poor old Carson, he's just not really an NBA player. That's just what it comes down to. He doesn't have an NBA role, and fare thee well, mate.
Mm. Yeah, maybe he'll make an appearance in the NBL. Who knows, maybe for the New Zealand Breakers or the Sydney
kill
Kings.
It. Like, he's like, you know how they talk about like quadruple A players in baseball?
Yeah.
You know, like Carson Edwards would absolutely destroy at any level below the NBA, probably. Maybe not like top flight Europe. Maybe he'd just be good. But, you know, like, yeah, he'd carve up in the NBL.
All right, Joe, thanks for coming on briefly. We're now going to switch to the full podcast with the Celtics Blog's Adam Taylor. Hello and welcome Welcome to the Celtics Reddit podcast. Ben Ballas here. Thank you for joining us. Hope you're doing well. We've, of course, got Wayne Spooney on the pod, but today we're very excited to welcome a special guest, Adam Taylor of Celtics Blog and the Celtics Blog podcast of the same name. Adam, how you doing, sir? Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure's all mine, man. You guys do such a great job with this podcast, and I love the Reddit sub. I'm doing well, man. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, man. We're very happy to have you and appreciate the kind words. Now, we're going to get to some takes from the people of Celtics Reddit a little bit later and get Adam's reaction to said takes, but we'll start with something a little bit more pressing, and that is Jason Tatum. Adam, there's been a lot of change this offseason. I think anyone who even vaguely follows the team is aware of that, and it's probably fair to say that all of that hinges on just a few things, perhaps most importantly, the progression and development of Jason Tatum. Is it fair to say that none of the changes we've seen this offseason so far matter if Jason Tatum isn't who we think he is, i.e. a genuine superstar?
I think that these changes have been made to... So the way I look at it is you need that internal development from Tatum. You need him to be able to read and react to double teams better, to be able to orchestrate plays out of pick and roll scenarios better. You need him to be able to understand secondary and tertiary reads rather than just, he's very comfortable spotting an open route one guy, but when that passing lane is shut down by the defense, that's where he becomes a bit more delayed in his ability to process what's going on around him and make that secondary or tertiary pass. So to me, that development there is the key development. Now, if he hasn't got that yet, if he's still working towards that, because he's still in his infancy of developing as a playmaker, then the other guys like the Dennis Schroeder acquisition, the Josh Richardson acquisition, I think that goes some way to bridging the gap while that development continues to take place. So I wouldn't put the successes and failures of the season solely on Tatum's shoulders in terms of development. But I think if we do want to class him as a superstar, that passing ability and that reading of the game definitely needs to take another step forwards or two step forwards before he's a genuine superstar, in my opinion.
Adam, if you don't think he can make that step to genuine superstar, do you think that the moves we made are even more important to get that flexibility so perhaps we can add sort of that third, maybe a little bit better than Drew Holiday type piece? Or is it just over, forget about it? If he doesn't take that next step, it doesn't matter. Unless you add Giannis, there's no real road to a championship.
Yeah, I mean, for clarity, I genuinely believe that the next step towards superstardom is 6 to 18 months away for him. Because it's only been 1 year where he's really been asked to orchestrate the offense as a playmaker as well as a scorer. And expecting that to happen after 1 year is a tall task for anybody. So I do think that next step is wide open, completely available. And logically, it seems to make the most sense that he will make that step. But in the interim, I do think that adding guys that can handle the rock a little bit, that can get their own shot and create for others, I think that does help kind of alleviate the stress. But I'm definitely not viewing this year as a championship contention season. I think that there's just too many other teams around the league that are deep. Brooklyn obviously being the biggest issue in the East, and Milwaukee. So I'd like this to be viewed as another year of development for Jalen and Jason. And then next year is when we should really expect those guys to be knocking on the door of that superstardom tag.
For Tatum, though, and whether it happens this year or the next year or three, what are the, so forget the eye test for a second, what are the metrics for that leap? Like, what stats should fans be tracking to sort of see if Tatum is trending up in those stats to sort of get an idea that he's, if not hitting that superstar mark, at least heading in the right direction?
So for me, I'd be looking at assist to usage ratio, which cleaning the glass tracks quite nicely for you. It's very succinct. It removes garbage time, which you wouldn't expect Tatum to partake in. That will show you how often he's orchestrating offense versus how often he has the ball in his hand. I'd like to see his foul drawing statistics increase as well, because obviously the best players in the league can get to the line at will and get those easy buckets to get themselves going. Defensively, it's really hard to track a player's development statistically on defense because it's such a team-orientated effort. I tend to lean mostly on the hustle stats, so deflections, contested shots, Tatum has shown that he's a very good off-ball defender when he's locked in, especially in the passing lanes. He gets his hands on a lot of balls. From there, you can look at things like his estimated plus-minus. I think dunksandfreeze.com track that very well. They do a great job there. And then just start to look at how efficient he's becoming as a scorer, how efficient he is as a passer, what's his assist-turnover ratio, what's his link-up play with some of the other guys on the team. I'm a big fan of the assist network visualizations. I think they're on pbpstats.com. You've got an assist network, and it shows you what player is distributing to who. So what you'd hope to see is, at the moment, that's quite limited for Tatum. It's mainly aimed at Jaylen Brown or last season, Kemba Walker. You'd like to see that kind of expand to multiple guys across both units, and you can see that he's becoming more ingrained in creating offense for others rather than just being a play finisher. He'll step into a play creator role. That would be the way I would track his evolution for what we're actually asking him to improve on in the next year or so.
Yeah, Adam, what type of... So you say you want to see him expand who he's passing to. And I would contend that he also just needs to be a more willing passer. I think he gets tunnel vision a lot of times. But what are the type of plays and sets that the Celtics could run? And I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot, and this is kind of a in the weeds question, but to get him to pass to guys that aren't just Jaylen Brown or aren't what will probably be Marcus Smart instead of Kemba Walker this year. You just think with increased spacing and more threats on the floor, it'll be easier to find like Rob as the role man, or are there specific things you want to see Ime run to help facilitate him passing to other guys, frankly?
So just to touch on that tunnel vision, and then I'll go into some ideas that I've got. That tunnel vision to me really pinpoints the fact that he is a great option when his first read is open. So if we look at it like if Jason's got the ball on the wing and he's looking for Rob Williams as the role man to hit that pass, but a defense takes away Rob Williams as a passing option, that's when Tatum gets tunnel vision, because he hasn't developed the skill yet to recognize secondary and tertiary passing options. And so when I'm talking about that, that is probably the best way to describe what I call the secondary options. In terms of play sets, I like Tatum operating down on the post quite a bit. I think that he's quite comfortable there. He's got the threat of the fadeaway from there. So if you can run some wedge screens into post actions and then ask him to create out of the post, maybe you run a wedge screen to get Tatum into the post and a Chicago action to get someone like Nesmith lifting off the corner, and then ask Tatum to be kind of like the offensive fulcrum. He gets the ball in the post as the Chicago action happens, and then Tatum kicks out, because Tatum's got that mid-range gravity where defenses are going to have to make that hard choice, especially when someone like Nesmith is coming off a pin down and a Chicago action. You could switch that up on Miami, which is another action that happens on the wings. If you want Tatum to be more of a facilitator, obviously pick and rolls, double drag screens are all going to be great. I wouldn't mind seeing some flex opportunities for him, getting people to run flex screens for him, asking him to come cut baseline and then redistribute the ball on wraparounds. There's so many options that you can develop for him that will give him route one passing lanes where the first option should be available. But again, when that option is taken away throughout the season, that's where we're going to see how much development he's made there. It also, obviously, with the Tatum scoring the bag that he's got, if you run these plays and shooting opportunities there, then you're just giving Tatum more and more chances to get his buckets and start feeling the game his way. And the more he scores and the more consistently he finds the bucket, the more the defense is going to hone in on him, and those passing opportunities are going to continue to open up.
Yeah, I got two follow-up questions there. So like you mentioned the Chicago set and the Miami set as well. Is there anything that you know about Ime Udoka where he might be more prone to running certain sets like that, whereas Brad wouldn't have been as prone to run that kind of offense? And subsequently, follow-up question is, where can fans like myself, and I'm sure others listening, go to learn more about those play styles and those play calls? Because I don't think that's necessarily something that like sticks with sort of like your tier one or tier two basketball fan to know that sort of level of offensive play knowledge.
Yeah, of course. I made sure to say ones that were very easily findable, very easily searchable, simply because they're two of the most common sets ran in the NBA. So in terms of Ime Udoka's playbook, I actually haven't got much idea of what we're going to expect. It's an anomaly to me. Now, there is another guy on Celtics blog, Adam Spinella, and he's a head coach of a team himself, and he's been diving into some of the teams that Ime has been working with, and he's kind of doing a proposed playbook of what to expect from Udoka. That should be out in a week or so on Celtics blog. I highly recommend people check that out.
That sounds awesome. Great.
For me, when I'm doing any film work, if I'm looking to learn about things, what I tend to do is I use Half Court Hoops, which is a paid newsletter of $5 a month. That's Gibson Piper, if you guys don't follow him, one of the best X's and O's minds in the planet. The Basketball Playbook on Medium is a free resource that details all of these plays, from something as simple as a 45 cut, which is just a cut from the wing at a 45 degree angle towards the hoop, all the way through to, I don't know, your flywheel offense or your 21 sets, whether that be 21 chase, 21 rip through, whatever you want to be. That's a great, the Basketball Playbook on Medium, and I highly recommend that, great resource. And the final one is learn-basketball.com, which is a paid resource, but it walks you through from the very beginning of how to understand basketball all the way through to some of these advanced sets that we're talking about now. And it takes you step by step.
Great. Well, people listening, I hope you're taking notes. Adam is a wealth of information here. I know I'm going to re-listen to this one already and write down some of these websites that you're recommending and prepare ourselves for the upcoming season so we actually sound like we know what we're talking about. Spoons, you got yourself covered there, but I got some work to do. Sticking with Tatum here, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the playmaking, I guess, being the obvious extension of his game. Is there another route for Tatum at all? Is it possible just like a jump in his scoring efficiency gets him to that sort of superstardom level?
Of course, yeah. I think that there's some guys that can be a superstar based off solely off scoring. I mean, Kobe Bryant was never really a playmaker, and he was one of the most loved players in NBA history. I know this is a Celtics podcast, but I think we can all accept the fact that he's a well-liked name within NBA circles not Celtic circles, but NBA circles as a whole. I can see Mike shaking his head. I think that, you know, being able to get to the line more, we saw that towards the end of the year. It's no shock that as Tatum gets to the line more, he becomes more efficient with his shot selection. He becomes more efficient with how often he's actually hitting his shots, because it gets you in that rhythm, right? I was watching a video the other day where Jan Madar was working with Drew Hanlon, and Drew Hanlon was talking about finding your shooting pocket. And that made me think, like, hey, when you're at the free throw line, you're naturally going to that shooting pocket. So the more you do that in a game, the more your muscle memory remembers, hey, this is where my shooting pocket is. When I'm pulling up off the dribble, the ball's going to be here every time, and my mechanics and my rhythm are all going to flow. And I think that's a knock-on effect of actually getting to the line during games, teaching your body, this is where I need to pick the ball up, and my mechanics are going to, I can work through my mechanics at a much quicker rate. I haven't done the numbers yet, but I'd like to see how that tracks with Tatum's scoring efficiency on games where he gets to the line above five times versus when he's not at the line five times, which would be 10 attempts, obviously. I think that probably has a coincidental knock-on effect that people don't look into. And then obviously just shot selection. I think quality of shot selection is huge, especially for Tatum, that has such a deep range and such an array of hot spots across the floor. Having him settle is the worst thing in the world, because he's so deadly from so many different spots on the floor. You want him to be more confident putting the ball on the floor and getting to those spots. Finally, I know I'm rambling on here. His handling transition is quite weak, in my opinion. I think his handling in isolation situations, in half-court situations, is more than acceptable. But if you watch him run the break, if he's got the ball in his hands, the dribble's quite loose, it leads to turnovers, it leads to really messy gather steps, and he can really, that's where I feel he's knocked off of his rhythm quite a lot. So if he can learn to either not run with the ball in his hands at speed and just be an outlet option, a play finisher option, or develop stronger handles or run at his own speed, that's going to open up a lot more as a playmaker and as a scorer in transition opportunities.
And just to kind of piggyback on that, and first, that's an awesome point by Drew Hanlon. I guess there's a reason he's a trainer for tons of the best players in the NBA. Yeah. Huh? Do you think, I mean, this kind of, you know, two versions of Tatum's superstardom, right? The passing version, which I'm obsessed with. I focus on Tatum's passing, like, too, and probably borderline insane level. Or like, hey, he just becomes like, he's scoring 33 super efficiently. He didn't do that in the second half of the season, but I mean, do you think he was close to superstar level after sort of that trade deadline when he started just ripping off 50-point games, or do you think he still wasn't quite there in the second half of the season?
No, I think we were seeing a version of Jason Tatum that's going to become the normality. At the moment, those games are becoming more frequent, and they're not so much the rule at the moment. It's still an exception based on this season, but I think that those are flashes of what prime Tatum is going to be at the floor of his prime, if we know it. I think that when I'm talking about his passing, one play that sticks out to me is that mad. You remember when the ball was going out of bounds? I can't remember who it was against, and he had that wraparound spin pass behind the back. To Time Lord. Like, to me, that just shows such a high ceiling in terms of play recognition, floor, and understanding where everyone is on the floor and quick decision making, that I just cannot imagine a world where his playmaking doesn't take these steps over time. I do think that we saw close to superstar Tatum after the trade deadline, and it's very funny because that's 2 years in a row where his game has just gone into another stratosphere after the All-Star game. I think that gives him more confidence. He plays with a bit more of a swagger after he's been named an All-Star, and I think he feeds on that as well. Obviously, just from watching the way he plays, the way he conducts his interviews. So I definitely think that we are starting to see the very beginning of Tatum reaching that superstar mountaintop.
Yeah, there's almost parallels between how he trends upwards within a single game and also how he trends upwards within the course of a regular season. It takes him a while to ramp up throughout the season. Also doesn't typically score particularly well within the first quarter of a game. So maybe something for him to address there, that it needs to sort of score more efficiently and effectively throughout the course of a game, including the beginning of the game. We don't have Avery Bradley anymore to go out and score the first five buckets for the Celtics. We need someone to score those buckets for us. And with a lack of shooting sort of, you know, through and through for this year's team, at least on paper, maybe Tatum, that's another area of his game that he needs to step up on. On his playmaking as well, just randomly the other day, I was watching the Celtics versus Warriors game. I think it was April 17, where like Steph went off for, you know, 40, whatever it was. Tatum went off for 44. It was an incredible game. And there were multiple plays where Tatum got into the paint and made the perfect kick-out pass to none other than Shami Ojeleye, who bricked all of those opportunities, those wide-open threes. Shami's now gone. You could argue that we're deeper, although not necessarily in terms of shooting. But I hope that Tatum continues to trust the kick-out pass, and I hope that now that the roster we have around him can at least knock those down with more consistency. And we're going to get to some Nesmith stuff on that in that vein a little bit later. Transitioning a little bit now, though, is there any other player in the league, any player at all, any active player in the league, Adam, that you could replace Jason Tatum with that would make this current team as constructed a contender?
As constructed?
Yes, but like if you replace Tatum with KD, like, would this be a championship
game? Yeah, I mean, your top five guys are always going to mean that your team's a contender, right? So you can say KD, maybe Davis could do so. You could look, maybe LeBron, even at his age, if you're classing him as a top five guy still, then he could. Harden probably could. We've seen Kyrie not be able to do that, so we can completely write him off from the get-go. Giannis is another guy that probably could because of the way Brown is. There's a few. I'd probably say there's probably seven guys that could arguably step in and take this team to a contender status. But if we're being real, there's too many teams that are too deep. And remember, if you don't have Tatum, the team that you're naming this player from most likely has Tatum on their team. And when you think about it like that, I just can't see it happening. What team, if you put Giannis on this team and give Milwaukee Tatum, are Boston good enough to get past Brooklyn or get past the LA Golden Girls, which they've got over there? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I'm not sure. So as constructed in the league as constructed, I don't think one player makes a huge amount of difference this year.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so, yeah, so Tatum is our ceiling, and no matter who we replace that ceiling with, it doesn't get us over the line. So Tatum is the ceiling. Smart, you could say Time Lord at the floor. I guess that makes Jaylen Brown the walls or the furniture or something in between the floor and the ceiling. Is it possible that a Jaylen Brown leap is actually more important than a Tatum leap in that vein.
I also think it's more likely, if I'm being quite honest. I think that if you look at Jaylen Brown, he's got a very reliable body of work that shows year-on-year progress in large strides. So, you know, whether it be coming into the league one-handed and having a really weak hand left dribble, to now he can finish ambidextrously around the rim, to, you know, he couldn't shoot pull-up threes. Now he can shoot pull-up threes either off the catch, off the dribble. It doesn't matter to him. His development has been very linear, which is rare in the NBA. In my opinion, I think development is never linear. I think Jaylen Brown's development is actually more likely just based on the track record of his progress from when he came into the league as a raw athletic slasher man to a where he is now an all-star two-way wing. That is a huge level of progress. And to me, that just says expecting him not to make that step again this year is going against everything he's shown throughout his career so far. So I actually think it's highly likely Jaylen takes another step this year.
That's interesting, because what I actually wanted to ask you about Jaylen is, are you concerned he might actually take a step back? I mean, he shot 50% from mid-range on some absolutely insanely difficult attempts, and his shot mix changed in the second half of the season. He traded those mid-ranges in for threes, which is something I supported. He actually became less efficient. His true shooting went from 59 to 58. So, I mean, if he's not shooting 50% on mid-range jumpers, and he's just kind of as good as he was last year, I mean, is there any concern, or are you just so confident in his, you know, he'll work on his game, it won't matter, he'll at least be as good as last year, probably better?
So I would, personally, for me, I would be happy with a 3 or 4% dip in true shooting, or in shooting efficiency overall, if it means he rediscovers his on-ball defense from 2 years ago. I would much rather have a guy that can lock you up and then shoot 47% across the field rather than a guy that can shoot 50, 51, 52, but he struggles to guard on the defensive end, because those extra percentages in points scored are just being allowed on the defensive end. So if Jaylen Brown could rediscover that on-ball defense, I'm happy with him taking mid-ranges. There was a really good article on The Ringer probably about a month ago now, talking about how guys like Chris Middleton and DeMar DeRozan, they buck the trend of this analytics movement where mid-range is the devil and you should avoid it at all costs. Because the fact of the matter is, defenses are set up now to guard the perimeter and the rim. There is so many available looks in the mid-range that having someone there that is confident and consistent benefits you, especially in the playoffs when it's a half-court based offense and that mid-range is just begging for people to get in there and take their shots from there. So if Brown wants to swap the 2 3-pointers a game for 2 more mid-range attempts a game, I actually think that brings value. And it also brings value to guys like Tatum and Nesmith, because now defenses have to sink that little bit further off the perimeter or push up a little bit away from the rim. So either Tatum and Nesmith are going to feast, or Rob Williams is going to feast down low, because there has to be some form of, what's the word I'm looking for here, compromise on that defense to deal with that mid-range threat from Brown. So I'd happily see him step back into that mid-range, but for me, it's that defense that's most important.
Interesting. So much to look for in this upcoming season with Tatum and Brown. And Adam, you've given us plenty of homework. Like I said, already going to listen back to this first segment and jot down all of those websites and resources you recommended so we can get prepared for this upcoming season. We're going to transition again slightly now. There's been a pretty relevant post, actually, just a total coincidence on Celtics Reddit by a user, Was David, titled, "For non-US residents, why the Celtics?" Spoons, not intending to exclude you here, mate. Adam, like, to what extent are you a fan of the team? And of all teams, why the Celtics?
So I do cover other teams from time to time, you know, but I've grew up a Celtics fan from probably about 6 or 7 years old, maybe a little bit older than that. Growing up here in the UK, when I was young, there was no basketball. It's soccer, 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 soccer. And I've always been the guy that's, you know, that annoying one that's like, hey, if everyone else is doing this, I don't want to do it. So soccer for me was always like that. It was just ubiquitous here. It gets pushed down your throat consistently. And I remember we had, this is how long ago it was, we had a new terrestrial channel. So a channel that wasn't on cable, it was free to own, launch, and it was Channel 5. very aptly named. And they started playing one basketball game a week, and they used to iterate between the Chicago Bulls, the LA Lakers, the Boston Celtics, and the 76ers. And it was whoever had the best game that week, like the most enjoyable, they would throw on TV on a Friday afternoon. And I started watching them with my mum. And, you know, you had Jordan and the Bulls with Pippen and Rodman, and they were just dominating everybody. And that was great to watch. But then you had this Celtics team that was getting their butts spanked constantly. They just weren't that good of a team. And again, it was that thing where I'd go to school and people would be like, the Chicago Bulls are amazing. Oh, the LA Lakers are great. Oh, the 76ers are so good. And I'm like, that's it. Then I need the Celtics. I don't want it. And I don't want to be like everybody else. And from then, I got really into the Celtics. Obviously, growing up, there was no internet, so I never got to understand box scores. I didn't really understand much more than a double dribble, rebound, score, and assists. It was very much just a base level casual fandom for a very, very long time.
Sure.
Going to high school, I'm playing basketball daily. I'm playing, like, you know, I'm playing for the city, I'm playing for the country youth team. League pass comes around, so I start watching more and more, but it's still a very casual level. I understand it a bit more now because I'm playing. But yeah, I got into it around about 1994, 95, and then I followed the Celtics as like my team in a way, since then, all the way through till we're in 2021. So it's been a long time.
Wow. Yeah. And I can imagine. Sorry, Spoons, after you.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
I can imagine the temptation there in 1994. I mean, I guess Jordan was technically retired at the time, but I know a lot of my friends at that period of time all became Chicago Bulls fans. For me, my dad played touch footy, you know, rugby when I was growing up, and Larry Bird just like looked like all of his Aussie mates that we'd see down at the footy club after the game, and that was enough to make me gravitate towards the team. It's just interesting, the sort of things that can sort of make you choose a team from so far away, particularly when there's far more appetizing and, I guess, dominant teams around at the time. Spoons, did you have something you wanted to add there?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I liken it to, I'm an Everton fan for the sole reason is Tim Howard was their goalie and he's American. So it's interesting how you can kind of latch on to a team and then it just becomes, you know, lifelong fandom.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you resonate with them as well. Like, I find that every team plays a very specific way. And like, I've always been about hard work and grinding. So the Celtics hard work defense kind of really resonated with me as I got older. And then it was just, again, like everyone said, like everyone's a Chicago Bulls fan. Everyone's a Manchester United fan or a Manchester City fan. Like, to me, that like if that's your reason for being a fan, just for success, then that's completely fine because you're, as an individual, you're entitled to just enjoy a sport. But I wanted an emotional investment in a team, and I wanted a team that I could emotionally ride the success with the failure. And I think that if you want to experience the full breadth of fandom, then you need to be on it. You need to be following a team that's going to take you across that roller coaster year on year, because you need the lows as much as you need the highs.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What about your, I'm interested to hear more about your career. So like, you're obviously based in the UK and yet you're this lead writer and podcast host for perhaps the biggest independent Celtics blog out there. I mean, they're literally called Celtics blog. how did you go from a Celtics fan in the UK to it being in such a prominent position in Celtics journalism like you're in now?
Prominent, I wouldn't call it a prominent position, but I appreciate it very much. luck, if I'm being quite honest, I think a lot of it is a large stroke of luck. So obviously basketball in Australia seems to be a lot more relevant than it is in England. I come across more Australian fans than I do English. I had no one to talk about basketball with at all. My daughter had been born, so I weren't really socializing as much because obviously family life becomes a thing. And I just opened a Twitter account and started tweeting about the Celtics, started writing blog posts that nobody read, recording podcasts that nobody listened to. For a long time, I was getting like 10 downloads on a podcast and 6 reads of an article, but I never did it for like making money or being a journalist or whatever was never why I did it. It was just because, hey, I want to talk about basketball. And if someone reads this, even one person, and I get a conversation out of that, then that's fulfilling my need to talk about the Celtics. And then over time, you know, people started reading the stuff. My downloads were started climbing, just consistency. I started writing for some other outlets. I remember I was at Hooped Habit with Fansided for a while back in the day. And I just emailed Celtics Blog one day, like, hey, this is my, basically, this is everything I've ever wrote on a link. This is everything I've ever said on a podcast on a link. I would love to write for you in any capacity, should you have an opportunity available. Jeff, who runs Celtics Blog, got back to me. Obviously, at the time, there wasn't any positions. And I just continued to work. And then every so many months, I would just check in. Hey, this is what I've done since the last time we spoke. If there's any other position available, I'd be super grateful. Eventually, probably a year down the line, they reached out to me like, hey, there's a position like it's, to come on as just a contributor and, you know, write whenever you want. If you don't want to write, that's fine too. So I did that. As at the same time, my Twitter following's growing and blah, blah, blah. And then from there, you know, I just worked my way up into a consistent contributor to a lead writer, took over their podcast, landed some awesome guests over the time. And then obviously with that consistency, your social media platforms begin to grow and then other websites begin to take notice and opportunities begin to open doors for you. Definitely difficult being from the UK. But I genuinely believe that the NBA is an international brand. I genuinely believe that social media has got rid of distances and borders in between countries. And I do have the occasional people that are like, you're English, you don't know what you're talking about, so we're not going to read or listen. And that's fine. That's completely fine. But then I have other people that appreciate the fact that I have that different opinion because I'm removed from the city and I'm removed from the culture of Boston sports in terms of geographic location and upbringing. So it's been tough, but it's probably been about 4.5-5 years now, maybe a little bit less, but it's been a heck of a ride.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. It's been really fun to follow you. I think like me being in Australia and seeing you get to where you started and where you are now in the UK, like there's a unique appreciation from other overseas fans, I think, to see the rise of someone in your position. So really respect the hustle. Like you mentioned, you've had some good guests on your podcast, and I've listened to all of them. Like you had Gordon Hayward on, you had Kendrick Perkins on. You're obviously a fan of the team. Like thinking about how I would feel in that situation, I would be petrified talking to Kendrick Perkins, talking to Gordon Hayward. You're obviously more professional than I am, but like, can you talk me through like how you like? Let's be honest. Like, how do you prepare yourself for that moment, and how do you maintain your composure through those interviews? Because I'd be absolutely shitting myself, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, for real, dude. Like, have you ever seen the film Cool Runnings?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know that scene where he's in the mirror and he's like, I see pride, I see power, I see a bad, mofo that won't take no crap. Like, I have to give myself one of those talks because you're Kendrick Perkins was probably the most nervous I've been for any interview.
Sure.
And like, it's been set up, it's 10 minutes until go time, and I'm looking in the mirror like, you need to stop sweating, you need to, you know, stop stammering, because this is, like, Perk will call you out if you say something wrong, and the last thing I want is to not have the opportunity to interview him again in the future. So, and then once the camera's on and you're talking and stuff, I try to treat every interview like I'm just asking you questions at a bar. And, you know, I keep it professional. I try not to let it become like, oh my God, Kendrick Perkins, can you tell me this? I try and keep it to a certain level of professionalism. But at the same time, I want to develop a relationship with you that I can hit you up in the future and be like, hey, Kendrick, do you want to jump on today? And, you know, you feel like, hey, Adam treats you well. He acts professionally. Hopefully they'll say yes in the future too. But man, I'm scared. Usually my palms are just dripping. I just try to... you know, but you only see my face on the camera, so you don't see the rest of me trembling.
That's right. That's great.
Adam, one thing I'll say, being that far away from Boston sports culture is a good thing. Trust me, it's terrible up here. You should hear that. You should hear the sports radio. I mean, it would drive you insane. Do you actually think the COVID and the lack of access for all of kind of the domestic folks covering the team has kind of been a benefit for you, though, because you've sort of leveled the playing field for someone who's, you know, thousands of miles away covering the team?
Oh, for sure. I mean, for me personally, I never actually got much access to the Celtics post games interviews and stuff, but that was fine because they're usually at 3 a.m. my time. But what I did get was I got access to pregame quite consistently. I was getting access to, you know, anytime there was a big like national press conference, I'd have media access there. Shockingly, other teams show me quite a bit of love, like the Dallas Mavericks show me a lot of love, and I don't know why. So, you know, I was sitting in on Luka Doncic's interviews post-game and being there for stuff. Like, it really did level the playing field, because now everybody with an internet connection that are known to the team and have those credentials to get into those press conferences, well, it's just a click of a button. I no longer have to worry about £600-700 flights across the ocean to try and get an interview with somebody. But the Celtics are a very, very tough team to get in with their media circle in terms of like their PR team. So I wish I had more access than what I did, but I'm grateful for the increased access to what I actually had in the first place.
No, interesting. We've certainly found, like, certainly not to that degree. We're not sitting in on any Luka Doncic interviews, but the caliber of podcast guests that we were able to get once the pandemic started just skyrocketed, and we're able to get, you know, folks like Abby Chin and just people closer to the team who would never bat an eyelid at, you know, let's be honest, like a fan-based amateur podcast. Suddenly they're available and they're willing to come on and talk to people like this. That's been exciting. She's great. Abby's super nice.
Yeah, she's an awesome person. I really like Abby.
Yeah, very, very welcoming and accommodating, particularly when it comes to small fries like us. Before we wrap up, though, Adam, we have scoured Celtics Reddit for some hot takes covering the full spectrum, of course. We're going to rattle some of these off, and Adam, we'd love to hear your reaction to some of them. We're going to start with a take from a user called Sea of Wine, which in lockdown has certainly been my habitat, a sea of wine. they go on to say, I want Grant Williams, not a high ceiling, but a competitive player who can guard from 3 to 5 in crucial moments for Ime Udoka's team, is a key player to hold, so to keep on the team. Adam, do you agree with this take? Is Grant Williams a key player for Udoka's squad this year, or is he more expendable?
I think the bit where it says can guard 3 through 5 is something I'd vehemently disagree with. I think we've seen him get exposed against quicker fours. Definitely, to me, I think Grant Williams is a guy you put up against big, lumbering big men. DeAndre Drummond, we saw him have a really good game against Jokic. I think Grant Williams is a high-level glue guy. And for that reason alone, you know, as a 14th, 15th man earning minimal salary, I think he actually is important to locker room success. But as a piece on the floor, we're going to have to wait and see. But guarding 3 through 5 to me is that's a bit of a stretch.
Understood. Moving on, this one actually comes from my very own Wayne Spoonie, who's on the pod with us right now, and it's titled The Start Aaron Nesmith Manifesto. And this is an issue that's very close to all of our hearts, but particularly Spoonie, who poured his life into this manifesto for a week or so. Spoons, I'm going to throw to you for this one, because I'm going to botch it if I try and summarize it myself. Because, so for Adam's sake, can you try and summarize the central thesis here?
Yeah, sure. And I threatened Ben with violence if he didn't include this in the Reddit rundown. So that's why we're talking about it. So basically, I know you, Adam, I saw a piece you wrote where you went back and forth with another Celtics blogger or Celtics blog writer, and your position was actually to start Aaron Nesmith. So I think hopefully you're going to agree with me here. But really, my point is that in his, you know, last year, his skill set was completely in his infancy, right? I mean, he shot decently well, but it's not like he was shooting 43%. But he kind of got defended like he was. You know, defenders really stuck to him tightly, and it opened the floor for Tatum and Brown. I mean, that three-man group had like a 14 net rating, but they only played 60 minutes together. And really, you know, I think his defense needs to take a step up, but he's got the potential. He's got a lot higher defensive potential than, say, Pritchard, who's a great fit on offense as well. And so, essentially, if you expect him to get just a little bit better on both ends, I think he's a natural starter, especially considering I just don't think Schroeder and Richardson are very good fits on the offensive end next to Tatum and Brown. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on the Start Nesmith campaign, movement, revolution, whatever you want to call it.
It's a scene, man.
I would like to be your assistant general in this movement. Viva la revolution.
Absolutely.
I've done two pieces on this last week. The earlier part of last week, the one that you've referenced there where I went back and forth, and another one on why Josh Richardson makes sense off the bench. And the biggest reason for me is Aaron Nesmith has shooting gravity. And when we spoke about forcing defenses to make into compromising positions, being able to utilize somebody with that free, that deep range scoring gravity that can defend, you know, I agree, he definitely needs to improve. At the moment, it's very much, I'm athletic, I'm fast, I will hurt you if I need to while I try and block the ball. That definitely needs to improve. But I do think that his skill set sits better with the starters than it does with the bench. And I also think that by moving Nesmith into that starting five, I know this kind of sounds like I'm expecting hockey rotations, but I'm not. But what in my head, what it makes sense is you're distributing the veteran presence evenly between starting five and bench unit. Now you have a bench unit that comprises of Schroeder, comprises of Richardson, and then whoever else you want to throw into that mix, of Pritchard, a Romeo, whoever. But you actually have two solid multi-year vets coming off the bench for you. Whereas if Nesmith was coming off the bench, well, now you're relying on one legitimate veteran bench presence, and then you need to start staggering Tatum or Brown. So I think that not only does it add continuity towards the lineup, I just genuinely want to be part of this revolution. I'm completely with you. I could talk about this for hours.
Awesome.
It sounds like a perfect fit from what you're saying. It's obviously got some much needed shooting there and kick out opportunities for Tatum and Brown, but we're also spreading the love as far as a veteran presence throughout all possible rotations throughout the season. So very glad to hear you're on board there, Adam. It's obviously music to our ears, and particularly Spoonie, who I'm sure we can't see him on the camera right now, but I'm sure he's weeping with joy.
Exactly. That's why I turned it on. Now, turn it off so you can see me cry.
It's finally been validated. Now, it may be anticlimactic to wrap it up with this question, but this is a question or a statement, I suppose, from user Evan Time. They go on to say, if Jabari Parker can play good enough defense to earn minutes on this squad, then he absolutely deserves a spot. The problem is his defense has been bad his entire career. So, Adam, what do you think? Is there much of a future on the Celtics for Jabari Parker in the near future?
I think the four is the weakest position on the roster, to be quite honest. I think because of that, Jabari Parker should keep his spot. He's one of the only bench guys really outside, like only big men on the bench that can really get in there and get their own buckets. Like Rob Williams can score with the best of them, but most of his points come off assists. Jabari Parker he's got a bit of a fadeaway game. He's got a low post game. Defense is going to be the big swing for him. Can he step in and just play, be a defensive role piece? We're not asking him to be a stopper. We're not asking him to be a linchpin of a defense. Just don't be bad. It's literally that simple. Just be a net. Don't be bad, and you're going to have a roster spot this year. If you are bad, then we're going to see Grant Williams step into that role, and I just don't think he's suited to playing the four. So I'd agree there that Jabari Parker should get the season this year.
Yeah, it's funny that like a failure on Jabari Parker's front is like the threat of Grant Williams stepping up to play that role. Like there should be an added incentive for Jabari Parker to do well. I just hope, I haven't seen any photos of Jabari Parker recently, but the next photo I see, I just want to see him like jacked, like if nothing else, to spend the offseason like getting super buff and like getting in game shape, because he kind of looked like a 2K, like my career player with no VC. When he came back and played for the Celtics, like he just had no flair, no, like, I don't know, no muscularity to him. It was kind of, he was a very vanilla looking player. So I hope to see some improvement on that front.
I want to see him reenact that Tatum picture that just went viral.
Yeah.
With him holding 100-pound dumbbell. Yeah.
I need myself an NBA trainer so I can start looking in shape, man, because these guys do it so quickly as well. Like a couple of years and they're enormous.
Absolutely, yeah. Just got to eat a shitload of tacos and lift a shitload of weights. That seems to be the Tatum regime. So something we can all aim for.
40 million a year is going to help there too.
It helps.
Yeah.
It
I got the taco part down.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Is that private? Yeah. Honestly, I genuinely put it down to the private chef. I think when you've got someone cooking your food and nutritionally managing everything that you consume, it's easy to build muscle because you don't have to worry about those things yourself.
If you can make a diet not soul destroying, which I have not managed to do in my life so far, then that chef is worth their weight in gold. Maybe that's a theme for a future off-season podcast, seeing as we've got a few weeks until the training camp.
Just find a private chef and just see what they do. I think that's a great idea.
Any private chefs out there willing to work for free, I'd love to have you at my house, in my home. All right, folks, that's all we've got time for. You can read Adam's work on CelticsBlog.com and, of course, the podcast of the same name. Adam, this was great, man. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure, man. I was really honored that you reached out and asked me. I've had a great time. Thank you very much. And thank you to everybody listening.
Yeah, likewise. Very happy to have you, and we'd love to have you back at some point in the future. Folks, we'll be back very early next week. Spoons, love your work, mate. Until next time, go Celtics. Peace. Thanks.